Learn more about the fascinating journey of Ibn Battuta, the first ever travel writing by Ibn Jubayr, and the courageous Chinese explorers Hing He. We bring you stories from the travels and lives of nine Muslim explorers that brought us modern-day geography, map-making, and cross-border trade. Mondays to Fridays during Ramadan 2016 at 8:15 a.m. Repeats at 6:50 p.m. The Global Village, the vast expanse of an unknown world discovered. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
30 years were to pass before Ibn Battuta hung up his sandals for good. He set out a pilgrim, probably planning to return to Tangier. But along the way, he grew into one of the rarest kinds of travelers, one who voyaged for the sake of voyaging. In the coming years, he would change his itinerary almost on impulse, at the merest hint of the chance to see some new part of Darul Islam, to visit a scholar, a revered teacher, or sultan. Time after time, he set out for a destination in a roundabout, or even an entirely opposite direction. Once, a mere 40 days by sail from India, but facing a months-long wait for favorable winds, he instead set out on a land route that took him there by way of Turkey, a Central Asia, and the Hindu Kush, a journey of more than a year. Hints of the persistence that marked his life appear early on. From Tangier, he proceeded across the Mediterranean, Morocco, and Ifriqiya, now known as Algeria, and then on to Tunis. On the way, two fellow travelers fell ill with a fever. One died from the other. Unscrupulous government agents confiscated his entire estate, which he was carrying in gold, to his needy heirs. Ibn Battuta himself was so ill that he strapped himself to the saddle of his mule. Yet fare forward he did, determined that
if God decrees my death, it shall be on the road with my face set towards the land of Makkah.
He also learned early the manners and courtesies of the road.
At last we came to the town of Tunis. Townsfolk came forward on all sides with greetings and questions to one another. But not a soul said a word of greeting to me, since there was none of them that I knew. I felt so sad at heart, on account of my loneliness, that I could not restrain the tears that started to my eyes, and wept bitterly. But one of the pilgrims, realizing the cause of my distress, came up to me with a greeting and friendly welcome, and continued to comfort me with friendly talk until I entered the city, where I lodged in the college of the booksellers.
It was Ibn Battuta's first and last recorded bout of homesickness. The pilgrim's kindness and the hospitality of the college of the booksellers made for what was literally a rite of passage. His home was now the fraternity of the Ummah, warned by the company of the educated men, the ulama, whom he would meet in palace courts and madrasas wherever he travelled, in Darul Islam. In Tunis, Ibn Battuta joined a caravan headed for Alexandria. There, two things happened to him that, as he relates it, set his sights forever on the travels he eventually undertook. In the first,
I met the pious ascetic Burhan al-Din, whose hospitality I enjoyed for 3 days. One day he said to me, "I see that you are fond of traveling through foreign lands." I replied, "Yes, I am." Though as yet I had no thoughts of going to such distant lands as India or China. Then he said, "You must certainly visit my brother, Farid al-Din, in India, and my brother, Rukn al-Din, in Sindh, Pakistan, and my brother, Burhan al-Din, in China. When you find them, give them greetings from me." I was amazed at his prediction, but the idea of going to these countries once cast into my mind. My journey never ceased until I had met these three and conveyed his greetings to them.
A few days later, while the guest of the pious Sheikh Al-Murshidi, Ibn Battuta had a dream.
I was on the wing of a great bird which was flying me towards Mecca, then to Yemen, then eastward, and thereafter going south, then flying far eastward, and finally landing in a dark green country where it left me. Next morning, the Sheikh interpreted it to me. You will make the Hajj and visit the tomb of the Prophet. And you will travel through Yemen, Iraq, the country of the Turks, and India. You will stay there a long time and meet my brother Dilshad, the Indian, who will rescue you from a danger into which you will fall.
As it turned out, the life-saving Dilshad did indeed arrive to rescue Ibn Battuta from danger in India. Cairo was Ibn Battuta's first taste of Muslim civilization on a grand scale. He entered Egypt at a time when a far-sighted ruler, a good administrative bureaucracy, and a strong economy reinforced each other and together encouraged peace, prosperity, and prestige. Egypt held a virtual monopoly on trade with Asia, which did much to enrich the Mamluk regime. Swell the sails of middle-class prosperity and drive forward the ship of state. To the young man from Tangier, it was nothing short of wonderful.
It is said that in Cairo there are 12,000 water carriers who transport water on camels, 30,000 hirers of mules and donkeys, and on the Nile 36,000 boats belonging to the Sultan and his subjects, which sail upstream to Upper Egypt and downstream to Alexandria and Damietta, laden with goods and profitable merchandise of all kinds. On the banks of the Nile, opposite Cairo, is a place known as the Garden, which is a pleasure park and promenade containing many beautiful gardens. For the people of Cairo are given to pleasure and amusements. The madrasas cannot be counted for the multitude. The Maristan Hospital has no description adequate to its beauties.
But Mecca was still Ibn Battuta's goal. He sailed up the Nile and caravaned east to Ayd Heb on the Red Sea coast, a transit town, brackish of water and flaming of air. Unfortunately, he arrived at a moment when the ruling clan was in revolt against their Mamluk sovereign in Cairo. So, making the best of the worst, something he became quite adept at, Ibn Battuta returned to Cairo and crossed the Sinai by camel, sojourning in the Khans and cities of Palestine in Syria till he reached Damascus, where he could join the annual Hajj caravan to Mecca. The fact that another caravan also left annually from Cairo tells us something of Ibn Battuta's temperament. Rather than endure a brief residence in Cairo, he chose to extend his travels. Ibn Battuta didn't travel at a steady pace. A ship could make 150 kilometers of progress, or even more, in a day's travel with the following wind. But expectations dropped drastically under less favorable conditions. For reasons of security, most overland travel was conducted in caravans, which on the flat could make 65 kilometers a day, but far less in difficult terrain. Thus, a day's travel was a relative notion, but in its time, it was the most useful measure. Bear in mind that Ibn Battuta usually gave distances in miles, probably meaning the Arab mile, which was 1.9 kilometers or 1.19 of today's land miles. Yet his narrative abounds with varied local measures, including the Egyptians' farsakhs. One of the only places where he mentions mileposts is in India.
Dihar is 24 days' journey from Delhi. All along the road are pillars, on which are carved the number of miles from each pillar to the next. When the traveller desires to know how many miles he has gone or how far it is to the next halting place, he reads the inscriptions on the pillars.
The Umayyad Masjid was one of Ibn Battuta's first stops in Syria. Join us in the 10th segment to experience Syria with Ibn Battuta.
The Global Village has been researched and compiled by Hafiza Rayhana Umar, narrated by Tufail Patel, overseen by Mufti Yusuf Musaji, a production of Radio Islam.